You're listening to WERALP Arlington 96.7 FM. Welcome to another episode of the world-famous award-winning Picture Lock. I'm your host, Kevin Sampson, filmmaker, film festival director, Washington, D.C. area film critic, and lover of film and TV. Picture Lock is a film review show in which we'll take an in-depth look at new releases, classic films, and I'll speak to filmmakers, critics, actors, actresses, and everyone in between on a national and local level. You can find all the back episodes and so much more at picturelockshow.com. The 2017 Rosebud Film Festival just took place this past weekend, and I want to just extend another thank you to everyone who came out, all the volunteers who assisted, the staff at Arlington Independent Media, and the filmmakers who are part of making the festival so great. I think we all had a good time. The award ceremony was moving. It was awesome. You should see photos up on the Rosebud Facebook page, Instagram, all that good stuff. And we recorded the award ceremony, so that'll be running on Arlington Independent Media's TV channel, as well as I believe it might make its way to YouTube. So if you want to check that out, the list of winners, etc., you can visit rosebudfestival.org. Today, I'm really excited to have my good friend Tim Gordon from thefilmgordon.com to come on. He recently went to the 2017 Sundance Film Festival, and I know he has a lot to say about some of the films that he saw. And with the Oscars right around the corner, I thought it would be good for us to talk about the top nominations, the ones that you want to know for your bracket this coming Oscar season. That's all ahead on Picture Lock.
Hi, this is Deirdre Evans Pritchard. I'm the executive director at the DC Independent Film Festival, and you are listening to Picture Lock.
You're listening to Picture Lock. I'm your host, Kevin Sampson. Man, on the line. He's been doing it for years, y'all. The founder of the Black Reel Awards, Washington, D.C. Area Film Critics Association president, Mr. Sundance himself, Tim Gordon. What's going on, brother?
Woo-hoo!
What's up, boy?
Not much, man. So me and Tim, we both just no notes. We just going to have a good conversation. So this is really kind of like what it's like to be a film critic. We're letting you guys, Picture Lock listeners, we're letting you guys in as two film critics just talking. Now, Tim, you just went to Sundance. How long were you there?
I was there for 8 days, man. Eight snow-filled, sub-freezing days. That's
yeah, I saw some of those photos, man, and you said that you heard some explosions go off. Explain that.
Well, basically, they had probably about 20 to 25 inches of snow, man, for the week that I was there. And it was so much snow in the middle of ski season, it was explained to me that they would set off shotgun blasts to try to get the snow that was packed up, that was coming down, to move down the mountain so they would create mini avalanches so that they wouldn't have a major avalanche. So it was funny to me because the first time I heard it, I'm looking around like, what the hell's going on? And everybody was walking around normal. Oh, player, you know, that's just them setting off some blasts in the hills. I was like, that's all?
Right.
So, yeah, it's a different culture out there, man, specifically doing the week and a half of that fest, man. So a lot of fun.
All right. Well, you know, you were able to see a lot of films. I saw you posting about it. And the mystery film that they showed was actually the one that you and I both had on our radar for most anticipated Get Out, correct?
Yes, it was. I didn't get a chance to see it because, you know, Tim did something that all film critics should do at Sundance, which is create balance when you go to the fest. You know, you want to be able to see 20, 25 movies, but you also want to be able to have some network time, some socialization time, some time to do some parties, some time to hit some panels. So I did a little bit of everything this year.
Wow. All right. So just tell us, let's talk about your experience first, and then let's get into some films.
Well, experience is the fourth year in a row, man. You know, as I was telling people, man, on previews, that you got to have a plan when you get down to Sundance, when you get to Park City, because if you don't have a plan and you just show up on the spot with no plan, you just kind of screwed, because everything happens like after opening night. That next day, man, you are immersed in films, and they literally have what I call six blocks of movies. So starting at 8:30, 9 o'clock in the morning, 11 o'clock, 1 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 5 o'clock, 7 o'clock, 9 o'clock. They just have blocks of movies, and they give you an option of between 4 to 5 movies a block. So they're about 30 P&I movies or press and industry movies a day that you can see. You just got to pick the 4 or 5 or the 3 or 4 that you're going to watch every day.
Yeah.
And it's one of each. So every movie that premieres at Sundance, it'll premiere at a public screening, and the next day they'll give an option. It'll be a part of the P&I grid. So that takes a little getting used to. The first time you ever go, you need to get with somebody who's already been there, because it's going to overwhelm you if you've never done it before. Very unique experience at Sundance.
Yeah, I haven't been to Sundance, but definitely Tribeca. It's very similar in terms of, you know, you got your, like you said, public versus P&I. And honestly, one of the difficult things as a critic is choosing what you're going to see, because one, we don't necessarily, like, we hear some buzz around these movies, but we don't know if it's going to be good or not. And so you're like, oh, I heard about this one, but this one is playing at the same time. Which one should I do? Plus, I'm trying to make this other one. Yeah, it's a crazy matrix.
I was going to say, it's interesting you would bring that up, because every year I go to Sundance, man, I pick up a new tool to put in my toolbox.
Uh-huh.
And this year, they actually had it, well, actually they've had it the last several years that I've gone, that they allow you, if you are a member of the general press, the working press, to pick 10 premieres that you want to go to. And it took me about 2 or 3 years to figure out how to maneuver that. And this year, I added a new spin to that, because you're absolutely right, Kevin. You know, when you're going through the grid and you're looking at movies, all you're looking for is, oh, it's directed by this person, it stars this person, this sounds good. You just don't know. So I think what I will do from now on is that I'm going to request 5 tickets in advance, right, of stuff that I really know I want to go to the premiere of.
Mm-hmm.
And then I want to be boots on the ground and start listening to the buzz, because there were a couple of movies this year that didn't make my top 10 that had horrible synopsis, and I was like, man, those movies sound terrible, but people ate them up and loved them. So one was a movie called Patty Cakes that sold for $10.5 million about an overweight rapper in New Jersey. And I had a conversation with a friend of mine who saw it, and he said, you know, he asked me, did I see it? I said, no, because I read the synopsis, it sounded stupid. He said, yeah, me too. He said, but when somebody told me, explained it to me, that it was Saturday Night Fever with hip-hop, I said, yeah, if they would have wrote that down, I would have went and saw that.
Yeah.
So you're right. There's a lot of guesswork, but I think I saw a solid amount of films. I didn't see Patty Cakes. I didn't see Wind River, which was a Taylor Sheridan movie, the guy who wrote Hell or High Water. I missed that. I missed The Ghost Story, the Casey Affleck, Mara Rooney film. But I saw a lot of the big premieres that were there, and I thought it went pretty well. So I'll talk to you about those momentarily.
Yeah, most definitely. You're listening to Picture Lock. I'm your host, Kevin Sampson. I'm talking with film critic extraordinaire Tim Gordon about his experience at the 2017 Sundance Film Festival. By chance, did you happen to see Nobody Speak, Gawker, Hogan, and Trials of a Free Press?
Man, of course I didn't see that, man. Neither would you. I mean, see, that's the thing that's funny, man. I tell people all the time, you know, I got into a huge discussion with a producer there who produced the documentary that I saw, and she was trying to tell me that documentaries and narratives are like on equal footing. And I'm like, no, they're not. The average person on the street is not going to pay money to see a doc over a narrative. They're just not. So that's one of the things I learned. So, no, I think I saw a couple of documentaries, including the Jay-Z produced Khalil Browder story that's going to debut on Spike in a month. I saw that. That was the last thing I saw at Sundance this year. And I also saw the documentary on historically black colleges called Tell Them We Are Rising by Stanley Nelson, which I think premieres in September later this year.
Okay. And what can we expect to see from the Jay-Z flick? Because I saw from your post that Jay-Z actually turned up in Park City.
Jay-Z actually did turn up, man. Very funny story. I literally never do rope lines, right, as a rule. You know, rope lines, for people who are listening, is when they invite the media down and you stand like cattle And, you know, you're in this spot and the other person's in that spot and the people just walk down the line and just do these interviews. So I, don't, as a rule, don't do those. But I was bored. It was like my last day at Sundance and I was just kind of freestyling it. And I had completely forgotten, Kevin, that, like, for every movie, I always RSVP that I'll do the rope lines, but I never do them. So I show up, you know, about an hour early, and the press person goes, in the mic, like Men in Black, you know, yeah, Tim Gordon is here. Yeah, I'll bring Tim Gordon back in a minute. I was like, bring Tim Gordon back in a minute for what? I go in this room, and there's about eight or nine of us in there, and they've got my, you know, a filmgordon.com thing on the bottom. You know, you stand here, this is your spot. I was like, wait, whoa. So that's how I ended up being in the room. Or actually, Jay didn't come through before the film. He came through after the film, which was the video that I grabbed. But yeah, Jigga was in the building, man. I sat down and looked over and was like, oh, snap, that's Jay.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we had fun, man.
Yeah, that's really cool, man. You know, doing red carpets, sometimes it sucks, and I ain't even gonna lie. I mean, Picture Lock versus Entertainment Tonight. Am I gonna be in the center of the step and repeat or at the outside? I'm gonna be at the outside. But when you got moments like that where you're like actually able to, you know, see somebody that you admire, you know, I've known for so long, it's always a good time. All right, so Tim, let's just get into what were some of those standout films that you saw that listeners can expect to see coming out this year in 2017?
Well, I made a list as I was going through this thing that I updated all the way to the end called The Best of the Fest, right? So I have my top 10 films. I think I saw 22, 23 total, but these 10 are the ones that really stood out. So going really quickly, number 10 is a movie that is going to debut on Netflix, I think, in mid-March. A story about a group of pledges being extremely hazed in Burning Sands from first-time writer-director Gerard McMurray and produced by Stephanie Elaine, who's done movies like Beyond the Lights, Love and Basketball, a bunch of other movies, right? And that movie, man, I'm telling you, I had to get on the phone with people who were Greek because it's like school days on steroids. So school days with a hard R, man. That thing is difficult to watch, and the abuse that people take trying to pledge fraternities, man. I was like, wow. Number nine was a film that was local.
Tim, can I slow it down for a second? Because, you know, AFIA is a non-hazing fraternity. But when you talk about, you know, the struggle and the Burning Sands, I got to get in there. So,
So here we go again. Every sorority and fraternity is going to tell you that they're a non-hazing fraternity. This brother is Greek. And this is based on something either he went through or something somebody told him. But I would be interested to get your feedback after watching Burning Sands, man.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I want to check this out because you know, when I pledged in undergrad and coming out, that was my junior year at the University of South Carolina. Theta New Chapter. What's up, bros? But basically, it's always interesting because, you know, you think about a film like School Days, right, from Spike Lee, which you just mentioned, and you have, there's so much that you can talk about. And I will ask, was this just like any Greek organization, or was this like one of the Panhellenic, the black?
Of course it wasn't. Oh, it was, really? These were the Mighty Brothers of Zamba Phi Zamba. Zimba, dude.
So, but I mean, in terms of, it was like, was it a white fraternity or a black?
No, it wasn't no white fraternity, man. This was a bunch of brothers.
Okay.
Literally beating other brothers into submission. Oh, man. So
yeah.
I'm not even going into detail, man. You just have to watch it.
Yeah, no. This is interesting because I gotta check this thing out to see how authentic or not authentic this is. But
it's pretty authentic, man. Stop playing. It's pretty authentic.
Yeah. Okay. All right. This is something to look look forward to. I think because it's interesting. Well, man, never mind. This is a whole off radio conversation.
Yeah,
number nine.
Man, it's off radio, man. I got a list to go through. Get off,
yeah.
Man. Number nine. Down in Baltimore, there's a school called the Baltimore Leadership for Girls that was created in 2009, and they have a step team, which are the focus of this documentary, which literally got picked up for $4 million. I can't remember. I think it's Amazon bought it or who bought it. But an amazing documentary that, as I said, that focuses on three members of the step team, including the captain, in their senior year after the first 3 years they had been competing in competitions and getting beat down. We also discover the rich backstory. You know, one of the women focused has a mama who lives vicariously through her daughter. There's the coach of the team, Coach V, as well as the academic advisor who helps get each and every graduating senior into a four-year college. Truly amazing story. People were sitting there like, oh, my God, that was great. So Step is my number nine movie that played at Sundance this year. Number eight was a movie that there was a morning at Sundance. I think it was Sunday morning last week, where they had Wind River at a theater about 10 minutes away from the P&I Theater. And then they were showing Mudbound at 12 o'clock. And that was the one, if you were following online, all of the people were torn because it was like, do I try to see Wind River and get back for Mudbound? Because Mudbound was one of those movies that was highly buzzed about.
Mm-hmm.
Tim elected that he thought Mudbound was special and I would blow off Wind River. So I saw The Hero instead. And what a treat that was, man. Sam Elliott plays an actor who's now doing voiceover work, who's over 70. He's in the twilight of his life. He's reflecting back on the one role that made his career where he played a cowboy in a movie called The Hero. And, you know, between his days spent, you know, frustrated in voiceover sessions, or sitting around with a former co-star who's now a philosophical weed dealer played by Nick Offerman.
Wow.
He gets into a May, December romance with Laura Turpin, if you watch Orange is the New Black.
Uh-huh.
And it is an amazingly heartwarming, tender film about people who are going through, looking back at life, and moving forward. Very nice, almost tailor-made for Sam Elliott, who spent a lot of time in his career as a character actor, who steps out as the lead. The Hero, I'm not sure if it's gotten picked up or when it's going to debut, but I would definitely love to get your opinion on that film when it comes out.
Most definitely.
Number seven, Kevin, you'll like this one, is a story of a couple that argues incessantly, and they were former musicians, you know, when they were courting,
uh-huh,
and decide to take their arguments and turn them into hit songs in the surprise hit Band-Aid. Band-Aid was great, man. I mean, it also co-stars Fred Armisen from SNL, and it was written, directed, and stars Zoe Lister-Jones. That was a lot of fun, man. So Band-Aid made my list because I thought that was really, really cool. Number six, if you remember the Jenny Slate, Jillian Robespierre film, what was it called? About the girl who had the baby or got pregnant. What was that called?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It wasn't like Plan B or something. Wait, let me see.
No, it wasn't that. It was something that came out like 2 years ago. And I remember they came to D.C. and I interviewed them, but...
Obvious child.
Right. So the two of them reconnect for this story of a dysfunctional family that has Edie Falco, John Turturro, Jenny Slate, and all of them have lots of secrets and infidelity. A wonderful, touching family romance is called Landline. And Landline was one of the other films, man, that a lot of people got a chance to see at Sundance. It made my list, as I said, at number six. Number five, and I'm saying uh-oh because I just looked at my list and discovered that I had 11 films on here instead of 10. So let's do number six again, which was another touching film that I saw on the last day of the festival. And that film was starring Shirley MacLaine about a really crotchety very determined businesswoman who is at the end of her life. She's 80 plus, and she doesn't want to live anymore, decides to kill herself, is unsuccessful, tries it again, and stumbles to the obituary page and sees a bunch of people that she knows who she thinks doesn't think that highly of, and they have these amazing obituaries written about them. So she decides to go to the newspaper, find the obituary writer, hire her to write her obituary, and then discovers that she has to change her life to be worthy of the obituary that this woman will write in the movie called The Last Word. Amanda Seyfried, Shirley MacLaine, and I can't remember the name of this young black child they have in it, who is absolutely hilarious. You have got to see The Last Word when it comes out. That movie was great.
Wow.
As an added bonus, Kevin, I had the great fortune of having the director, writer-director of the film, sit literally, I think his name is Mark Pellington, sit right in front of me at the screen, and I spent the movie grabbing his shoulders, you know, giving up the thumbs up sign. I was like, oh, yeah, player, it's pretty good right here. So that was a lot of fun, man. So now we get to the top five movies of Sundance for me.
All right.
Coming in at number five, you watch her on The Daily Show, Jessica Williams. They've written a movie called The Incredible Jessica James about this girl who has suffered this breakup with Lakeith Stanfield, if you watch Atlanta, who plays the philosophical weed dude that hangs out with Paperboy.
Yeah, that's my
she
man.
Can't get over, right, she can't get over her relationship with him. She meets this other dude who's also recently divorced, and the two of them start this kind of like really kinetic, interesting relationship as she is trying to navigate her life. Smart, witty, really, really funny. Jessica Williams leaps off the screen. The Incredible Jessica James is a lot of fun, man. Really nice movie.
Yeah, let me derail this for a second. Yeah, if you mentioned Lakeith Stanfield, he's one of these dudes, and I was talking to somebody about this recently, a little while back, like last year. So I met him at Tribeca for a film called Live Cargo. And that film was black and white. And to me, it was one of those masterpieces that just went under the radar. Shout out to the film's director, Logan Sandler. But that in my mind was when I said, okay, Lakeith Stanfield is a dude to watch, because, you know, we first kind of saw him in Short Term 12. That's what, like, his breakout performance. But it seems as though he's one of those guys that, like, everything, if he's attached to it, you know, it's going to be smart. It's going to be witty. To me, he's like that young brother that, like, just makes great choices in terms of what he does. The other thing I was going to say is, I think, didn't Crown Heights play at Sundance as well?
Right, right. He also starred in Crown Heights. And I want to say, was he in a third movie? Because I talked to Lakeith Stanfield and hooked up with him at an after party. And he and I had met several years ago when he was in Selma.
Okay.
And Travis Hobson and I met him and Omar Dorsey, who later went on to be Hollywood in Queen Sugar.
Right,
so,
right.
So, you know, I was teasing him when I ran into him because I saw him a month and a half ago at the Critics' Choice Awards, and I was, you know, at the table with Atlanta, and I was taking a picture with Donald Glover, and both Paperboy and Lakeith Stanfield got into it. And, I mean, they were playing around, drunk, having fun, but security had to rush over there, and Donald Glover was like, whoa, 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 player, they with me. And the guy was like, is that your brother? And he was like, yeah, traditionally speaking. So I reminded Lakeith Stanfield of that story, right? He was like, yeah. He said, dude, we was turned up, man. I don't remember none of that. I said, I bet you don't.
That probably explains that dance that he had on stage.
Oh, yeah, man.
In that the
dude,
Kanye
he is,
moment.
He is lit, man. So, yeah, so that was my Lakeith Stanfield Sundance. So you got it. I know you rose button early in the year, man, but you got to figure out a way to get to Sundance, bro.
I know, man. I know. All right, I'm sorry. I derailed. I just had to talk about my mans right there.
Hey, man, you know, but guess what? You derailed me, man. But see, pros don't mind being derailed, man. So coming in at number four.
There we go.
Man, one of the movies that I thought was fascinating, and I put it this high on my list, was the story of a young girl, Kevin, in high or in elementary school who decides she loves Jesus so much that over her mother's objections, she enters the nunnery in high school to become a nun, only to discover that during the process, because it, in addition to her story, the side story was this is in the mid-1960s when the Catholic Church was going through its reforms and they introduced something called Vatican II, which was to reform the church. And this woman, you know, under the strict hand of this almost abusive, Mother Supreme, played by Melissa Leo, who I honestly believe if whoever buys this movie, if they got enough money to mount a campaign, Melissa Leo is worthy of a best supporting actress nomination for her work in Novitiate, which is what the film is. Don't ask me, man. We struggle with the pronunciation of it, but it's Novitiate. You know, this film about the Catholic faith and this really kind of like searing look at it, directed by director Marjorie Betts. Really good movie, man. So I put it high. I really liked it a lot. And again, I want to come back to you when you see some of these movies.
Yeah, most definitely.
Number three was the sequel to the Academy Award-winning film, environmental film, An Inconvenient Truth from Al Gore. This one was 10 years later. This is the Inconvenient sequel. And to tell you that this movie kind of really kind of presents new evidence from 2006 to now about climate change and the disasters, I will just simply tell you that a film critic buddy of mine from New York sat next to me. It was me, Travis Hobson, Stephanie Mary from the Washington Post, and this critic, Nadia Neo from New York. She sobbed through the last half of this movie, man. That's how damning the presentation on screen was. And it was also ironic because we watched that movie on opening night. The night before the inauguration, and the last 10 minutes of the movie were Al Gore meeting with Donald Trump to try to keep climate change, after he had become president-elect, to try to keep climate change on the docket, which ironically the next day the White House took it down right after the inauguration, man. So it was a very surreal experience, man, watching this movie with the timing that we saw it. So that movie finished number three on my list, man. Really strong stuff.
Real quick, because I know, obviously, and I don't want to go political on this, but when can people expect to see it? Because obviously this is something that, you know, a lot of people would want to see and push out.
It is on Netflix. Netflix already bought the film before the festival. I don't know when they plan on releasing it, but you will know when, I guess, we'll all know together.
Yeah.
Now, these next two movies are special because, to me, these two films were head and shoulders above all the other films I saw at Sundance. So instead of saying film two and film one, I almost call them 1A and 1B. So I'm going to go with 1B first. 1B is a movie called The Big Sick. And The Big Sick is based on a real story of a Pakistani stand-up comedian, I forget the guy's name, the real guy's real name, who has a family who wants him to marry, you know, stay within his own, and they've been setting him up with all these various women, and he falls in love with a Caucasian woman that he has to hide the relationship because he fears he's getting kicked out of his own family. This movie is a combination to me of Top Five, what Chris Rock did with all those comedians. It's also of a very melodramatic kind of Notting Hill-esque sort of a story. Very funny, very well written. He is dating this woman, and for the sake of his family, he kicks her to the curb only to have her become really, really sick and then discover that he really loves her. Oh, my God. Man, this movie was epic. I came out of that, and we all looked at each other. I said, not only is this movie going to make eight figures, it's going to, you know, be a $10 million-plus movie that's a pickup. It's going to make a lot of money at the box office. And the next day, the movie sold for $12.5 million.
Wow.
So I was right. The Big Sick, really, really solid film, man. That's funny. I could see it playing, say, in early September, late September, early October is one of those movies that might be on the radar. And the 1A movie of the festival, the one movie that I think really, head and shoulders, was just absolutely great, was the Dee Reeves follow-up to both Pariah and Bessie, mm-hmm. which was based on Hillary Jordan's book, Mudbound. Mudbound is absolutely epic in scope. It is a story that's well told about two families in Mississippi in the mid-1930s and how before the war starts, right, when the war starts in early 1941, the brother of the lead goes to war, the white brother goes to war and becomes a fighter pilot. The oldest black son of the black family that lives on the farm goes to war and becomes a tank commander, and how their purview is shaped about the world after they go to war and spend time in the country and then come back to Mississippi, become friends, and all hell breaks loose. This movie, man, the third act of this movie is some of the hardest stuff to watch, and I was incensed when I walked out the theater. But I love the movie. I'm saying because of what happens to one of these characters.
Mm-hmm.
But Mudbound, cinematography is tight. Every performance in this movie works, from Carey Mulligan, Jason Clarke, Garrett Hedlund, and that one white family, to Mary J. Blige, Jason Mitchell, who played Eazy-E in Straight Outta Compton.
Okay.
This movie is scope is epic, and it literally just got picked up 2 days ago for $12.5 million by Netflix. I'm not sure when it's coming out, but my guess is you're looking at October or November that they're going to release this thing, because this movie, above all else, is nothing more than a walking awards contender. Mudbound, absolutely fantastic. 4 stars. Favorite film I saw at the festival, man. I love that movie, man. And everybody else did as well.
All right, you're listening to Picture Lock. I'm your host, Kevin Sampson. I'm talking with Tim Gordon, who just ran down his top 11 films from Sundance 2017. Tim, we're going to have to take a break in a second, but thanks so much for running that down for us, man. I mean, that's definitely a lot of movies to look forward to.
That's probably, hey, man, that's what I do, man. That's why they call me Tim 10,000, baby. I see about 300 of these a year.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll hear from some sponsors. We'll be right back. Ride sharing is all the rave these days. Wherever you're headed, count on Lyft for rides and minutes. Whether you're riding solo or with friends, with Lyft, you've got options. Get picked up by one of their drivers who will get you where you need to go. When the ride ends, just pay and rate your driver through your phone. It's quick, it's easy, and just a couple taps away. Visit Lyft.com for more details. And if you haven't tried Lyft yet, but want to give it a whirl with a $50 ride credit, sign up at Lyft.com/invited/picturelockshow. That's right. If you're a new member to Lyft and in an eligible market, you can get a $50 ride credit with PictureLock. Again, that's Lyft.com/invited/picturelockshow for a free $50 ride credit. Excuse me. Attention movie addicts and cinemaphiles. I'm talking about the folks that catch multiple movies a month in theaters. I'm talking to the folks that know some movies just shouldn't be seen on the small screen. I'm talking to the folks who look for advanced screenings so that you can have a little discount on your monthly allowance for entertainment at the movies. I know you because I used to be you before becoming a critic and being able to get to screenings. Trust, I wanted to see so many movies at the theaters on the big screen, but you just don't always have the money to do it. And the way that tickets are these days, it can become astronomical. The struggle is real. That's why I want to introduce Picture Lock listeners to MoviePass. MoviePass is the nation's premier theatrical subscription service, allowing members to see a movie every 24 hours for a flat monthly fee. Let me say that one more time. To see a movie every 24 hours for a flat monthly fee. MoviePass is accepted at over 93% of theaters nationwide. It offers several types of plans, ranging from annual contract to month-to-month. There are no restriction or blackout dates, and MoviePass members are able to see up to one traditional 2D movie once every 24 hours. You simply need an iPhone or an Android phone with GPS. Just go to moviepass.com/partner/picturelockshow and sign up for the cheaper way to do movies. Again, that's moviepass.com/partner/picturelockshow. And I'll see you at the movies. You're listening to Picture Lock. I'm your host, Kevin Sampson. I got my good friend on the line, Tim Gordon of thefilmgordon.com. He just broke down his top films from Sundance 2017. And with the Oscars around the corner at the end of the month, you know, I wanted to have Tim come on so we could just have an Oscar nomination discussion. We're just going to talk about, you know, the big six, the top things that you might want to know so that you can go ahead and check out so that you can not have your bracket be busted. Tim, welcome back to the second half of Picture Lock.
What's up, bro?
All right, man. So finally I can get back in on the conversation because I think I've seen many of these films. Now, I haven't seen all of them, but let's start out with Best Picture, man. We got Arrival, Fences, Hacksaw Ridge, Hello High Water, Hidden Figures, La La Land, Lion, Manchester by the Sea, and Moonlight. What are you going to go with for Best Picture?
All right, now, I wanted to say this. I wanted to do this small plug before we begin.
Uh-huh.
I just want to say, man, for people out there who are seeing the Oscars looking like the BET Awards this year, there's an important reason, man. This was a historic year, and as I explained on several radio interviews last week, because we run the Black Reel Awards, I've been tracking Black Oscar winners since we started back in 2000. And between 1927, which was the start of the Academy Awards, and last year, there were a total of 38 Black people who had been nominated. Now, some of them had been nominated more than once or several times, but 38 Black people that were nominated. We had 18 African Americans nominated in a single year.
Wow.
Now, yeah, so when you call it watershed, transcendent, whatever word you want to use, that less than half of the total for the first 88 years we got in one year, A, it's not going to happen every year. B, it's a cross-section of the Academy being reactionary because they've been tired of hearing Oscar so white for 2 years.
Yeah, exactly.
And then C, it was just a crop, as we're going to talk right now about Best Picture, that you had three films for the first time ever have Black producers in Fences with Denzel Washington, Hidden Figures with Pharrell Williams, and Manchester by the Sea with Kimberly Stewart. And that's not even talking about a fourth movie. What the heck is it? There's one more movie that's in there. That Moonlight. That doesn't have a Black director, but it's got a Black point of view. So
Moonlight has a Black director? You mean producer?
No, it has no Black producer. That's Brad Pitt's company, A24.
Yeah, no,
Plan B. I apologize. That A24. Plan B that produced that, the same folks that produced 12 Years a Slave several years ago.
Yeah, no, so, sorry. You had just said director. That's why you meant producer.
I meant producer. My apologies. Three black producers in that category. But I think it's very, very interesting to note, and we cannot let this moment pass. Especially as we're now in Black History Month, to understand that this is Black achievement at the highest level and what a year is going to be. So having said all of that, my gut feeling is it's going to come down to a two-horse race. It's going to be between La La Land and Moonlight. And I think a lot of it has to do with these other categories that we're going to talk a little bit about later. I think that Barry Jenkins, in my mind, is going to win Best Adapted Screenplay. And I think that Damien Chazelle will probably win Best Original Screenplay, and he's probably going to win Best Director. If those two things occur, my money is on Moonlight to win Best Picture, because I understand they're going to want to spread the wealth and not ordain one film as like a super film. There's no super film this year. So between Moonlight and La La Land is where these two categories are going to, or this one particular category is going to live. So my gut tells me Moonlight is the movie that they're going to pick as the movie that they will immortalize. La La Land is going to get its fair share of wins, but it won't win this category to me.
Yeah, you know, taking it back to 12 Years a Slave and how I believe that one won Best Picture that year, but Steve McQueen didn't get it for director. I could definitely see your theory behind that win. For some reason, I feel like La La Land will take it for Best Picture, but I definitely agree. La La Land was my number one movie of last year. Moonlight was number two. It is one of those things where it could go either way. I'm going to go with La La Land. And, but you know, like you said, I think honestly, you and I, we saw La La Land. The first time was in Middleburg, right? Was that your first time?
That would
time?
Be correct. No, okay. I saw it before Middleburg,
okay.
A couple of days before, but I saw it again at Middleburg.
Okay, all right. Well, so at the time when we saw it at Middleburg, or for me personally, that was my first time seeing it, till now, La La Land is getting on my nerves. The first time I saw it, I thought it was magical, and from then on, I knew it was something special, and I've been saying, check the tapes, you know, I've been saying this is the number one movie of last year, but the it's one of those things where, you know how, like, you see something, and it's something special, it's something, you know, sacred kind of thing. And then all of a sudden this machine gets behind it. And now it just feels like it's been pimped out. It's almost like I used to love her, you know, with Common talking right. about how hip hop went to the West Coast. And it just doesn't feel special anymore. And so, like, now when I hear about it, I'm just like, ugh, please, like, I don't know. But yeah, again, I'm going to go with La La Land. I think that, you know, in terms of the feat that they achieved technically with actually filming it, the choreography with the cameras, the dancing, all that good stuff, you know, Best Picture would probably go La La Land. But I do agree with your assessment. It could go to Moonlight as well.
All right, well, hit me up in the next category, man.
Let's go to actor in a leading role. We got Casey Affleck, Manchester by the Sea, Andrew Garfield, Hacksaw Ridge, Ryan Gosling, La La Land, Viggo Mortensen, Captain Fantastic, and Denzel Washington for Fences.
All right, so this is good because we had a two-horse race again. I personally have been Team Denzel from day one, and please understand it's not that Team Denzel for me is because Denzel's a brother. I just looked at Denzel Washington's career, right? And I think that Denzel Washington has been exceptional in five roles, right? And he has gotten nominated for each of these roles. I thought that the depth or the range that he displayed, because there's scenes, because his character so engulfs this movie and takes over every fiber of the movie. He's happy some scenes. He's menacing in some scenes. He is a bad dude in some scenes. He's an honorable man in some scenes. Casey Affleck's performance in Manchester by the Sea, to me, is a one-note performance that he is kind of somber, and it's just degrees of somberness throughout the entire film.
Right.
And for that reason, and in addition to that, an article I put up on Facebook this morning, that according to 538, they're now saying that Denzel Washington's chances of taking the Oscar have increased because he won lead actor at the Screen Actors Guild Awards over the weekend, and his percentage has now jumped up to 82% because that's one of the precursors that people who win at SAG usually win the Oscar, and that the sexual allegations from Affleck are now starting to cause voters to pause because, as Tim Gordon has said on this show and others, during this season, voters look for reasons not to vote for people as mm-hmm. opposed to looking for reasons to vote for them.
Mm-hmm.
So for that reason, I think that Denzel Washington has a better than fair chance to join the Mount Rushmore of Hollywood. There have been five people, count them, five people that have won more than two Oscars, and four of them have won three, and one of them has won four, and Katharine Hepburn. So maybe it's five that have won three and one, but I know that that club is small. And in order to get that third Oscar, man, I mean, you're talking about people like Jack Nicholson, Meryl Streep, I mean, Daniel Day-Lewis. You're talking about the creme de la creme of
right, acting. Right, right.
Denzel Washington, I honestly believe, is going to pull this out because he's well-respected, he's well-liked, And I think, as I said earlier about Affleck, that hiccup might just be enough to get Denzel his third Oscar.
Yeah, you know, I'm not even going to comment much on this because I think you just hit the nail on the head. I definitely think this should go to Denzel Washington. And I think it should be said that Casey Affleck does have the sexual allegations, the lawsuits that were brought up against him, because as we've talked about before, I just don't think it's fair how everything was derailed for Nate Parker. But suddenly with Casey Affleck, we don't talk about that. But you're right. 100% agree with you. That's the actor in a leading role. I mean, the man killed it. So let's move forward to actress in a leading role. We got Isabel Huppert for Elle, Emma Stone for La La Land, Meryl Streep for Florence Foster Jenkins, Ruth Negga for Loving, and Natalie Portman for Jackie. I'm going to go ahead and start this off. Jackie, Natalie Portman gets it, hands down. I just think that she had an absolutely transformative role and performance. That's what I was looking for, performance on the big screen. She elevated a so-so movie to, you know, something that's worth talking about to see her performance in it. The mannerisms, the physicality in her performance. I just think that it was one of those standouts. I think she gets her second Oscar.
No, I mean, I'm not even going to say that much, man. This was not even close. Natalie Portman in a landslide. The only thing that would have made this more interesting is if Amy Adams, who had been nominated 5 years previously, had gotten in. Mm-hmm. I honestly could have seen a case that I honestly thought that, you know, the Oscars doesn't like people that they really like who gets multiple nominations to keep losing year after year, which is why Al Pacino upended Denzel Washington, which is why Martin Scorsese finally won an Oscar for The Departed. So with no Amy Adams in this race, this is really easy. It is Natalie Portman all day and twice on Sunday.
Most definitely. I think we can agree on that one. Actor in a supporting role, we got Mahershala Ali from Moonlight, Jeff Bridges, Hell or High Water, Lucas Hedges, Manchester by the Sea, Michael Shannon, Nocturnal Animals, and Dev Patel with Lion.
Interesting right here.
Yeah.
No, I was going to say, this is interesting because Mahershala Ali has literally won every award, you know, minus the Golden Globes, right? So he won again at SAG. He won the Critics' Choice Awards. He's been winning Critics Association groups. The only thing that gives me pause is that Michael Shannon and Nocturnal Animals, I think, along with Jeff Bridges, are going to pose enough of a challenge to him, with Lucas Hedges also now being in the race. I think that Mahershala Ali is still going to win because Moonlight as a movie is a film that so many people are talking about, and it's in the race in so many categories. I'm going to stick with Mahershala Ali, but Shannon and Bridges, man, give you pause, man, because both of those dudes are really, really good. But I just think Mahershala Ali was in far too many movies in the fourth quarter of this year, and you got to reward this brother. And it's going to be that night because, again, Hollywood is reactionary. So he'll be one of maybe four black people who will take the podium to give Oscar speeches, man. I'm not lying. I'm just being real, man. So that's another one, man, for you.
Now,
put me down for Ali.
Yeah. No, I agree. As I said before, I said it on Let's Talk Live, I think it goes to Mahershala Ali. Like you said, I think honestly, Dev Patel, I feel like that was just kind of like, again, the reactionary, like, let's give it for diversity, because he didn't really do that much in that film. To me, personally, I felt like the little boy did a lot more than Dev Patel did. Michael Shannon was good, but I think, as we experienced with the Golden Globes, what's his name, Aaron Paul Taylor, I think that he had more of that polarizing a role. Like Michael Shannon, this is good, but I've seen him do some things that are much better. And, you know, Hedges and Bridges, I think they both did well. But, you know, Mahershala Ali was only in the film for the first act. But you feel his presence even when it's absent. So you feel his presence, his character's presence, still hovering over all the decisions that, what was the boy's name? Because he had three different names.
He was Little initially, and then he becomes Chiron.
Right, exactly. But you just see how, like, Juan's, Mahershala Ali, his character's name was Juan, how his presence was ever present throughout the film. I mean, a stellar job. I mean, Mahershala Ali has had a stellar year. So, yeah, I'm going to go with him as well. All right, actress in a supporting role. We got Viola Davis for Fences.
Stop right there. Huh? Stop right there. You can read the rest of those other four. Viola Davis has won everything, will win the Oscar, overdue. It's a non-starter. She is the lock of the night. You know how they say, you know, the lock of the week? She is the lock of the Oscars. If nobody else, nothing else happens, she's getting an Oscar.
Right. No. You're totally right to stop me. You know, she was nominated prior for a supporting role in Doubt, leading role in The Help, and now for a supporting role in Fences. 100% agree. It's going to Viola Davis. I don't know how Nicole Kidman got in there, but I will say Michelle Williams, her brief moments in Manchester by the Sea. There is one scene, and I think you know what I'm talking about, when she's talking to Casey Affleck's character. Absolutely heartbreaking. It was amazing, but it's not the powerhouse that is Viola Davis. That woman deserves her Oscar, no doubt, 100%. We agree right there.
Well, I was going to say, man, the only other thing about this category that I thought was a massive snub was Janelle Monáe was great. I thought she was better than Octavia Spencer in Hidden Figures, and I thought she was absolutely great in Moonlight. And I think if this category for me would have been perfect and more competitive, if you take out Spencer and put in Monáe, but at the end of the day, the scene where, that's right, I've been standing here 18 years, I got a right to stand here.
Right, exactly. When you got Viola Davis yelling, spitting, and crying at the same time, you know it's, whew.
Oscar.
But listen, no, I agree with you. I think Janelle Monáe is definitely worth mentioning. I mean, just thinking about how her coming on the scene in terms of acting, she was in two films in which she really did a great job with her character. I agree. I think it would have been Janelle Monáe for her character as Mary Jackson in Hidden Figures, which, again, a powerhouse dynamo. And so, yeah, I mean, for me personally, Janelle Monáe is like actress to watch after this year. And not only that, her and Mahershala Ali, that combination, it just seems to be a winning combination for movies. So anybody looking to cast people in the future, you might want to do that. Your movie might be talked about during Oscar season.
Absolutely.
All right, let's bring it on home before we got to cut out. Directing, best director. I think we kind of already talked about this, but we got Arrival, Denis Villeneuve, Manchester by the Sea, Kenneth Lonergan, Moonlight, Barry Jenkins, Hacksaw Ridge, Mel Gibson, and La La Land, Damien Chazelle. Now, for me personally, I think that it really just comes down to Barry Jenkins versus Damien Chazelle. You talked about this in the beginning of this segment, just in terms of how it could kind of go either way. I would love to see, man, it's so hard. Because for me personally, I think both of these directors, if they could crack that Oscar in two, give it to both of them. Because what Damien Chazelle pulled off with La La Land, that's a huge feat. The performances that he pulled out, the choreography, like I said, with the cameras, creating this vision that he's been holding on to since prior to Whiplash, to actually see it. He swung for the fences. He's certainly deserving. At the same time, Barry Jenkins' direction was amazing in Moonlight. The performances that he got out of his characters, and especially covering the young man from three different times in his life, I got to see the screening for Moonlight, and after Barry Jenkins got on stage, he just said that he didn't let the three men or boys and the man meet and talk about their characters or anything. He didn't want them to meet. He just wanted them to have their own Lil Chiron and I forget the other one that they call it, but. I just think he did an amazing job. He really is one of those directors that when you listen, he's a very smart, intellectual person. He really thought through Moonlight, and I think that you just see a masterpiece presented to you when you actually watch Moonlight. So, man, I honestly don't know. It could go either way. I don't know, Tim. What do you think?
Well, it comes down, like you said, I agree with you, to these two gentlemen, and history is going to be made either way. Either it's going to be Chazelle, who becomes the youngest Best Director winner, or Barry Jenkins, who becomes the first Black Director winner.
Mm-hmm.
I personally believe that they're going to give, like I said earlier, I think it's going to be Damien Chazelle is going to win Best Director over Jenkins, but I think Jenkins' consolation is going to be that he gets easily wins Best Adapted Screenplay. Chazelle is going to win Best Original Screenplay. And then it comes down to, does La La Land get knighted as a movie in immortality like Shakespeare in Love over Moonlight? Or does Moonlight really kind of become that movie that so many people, because you got to remember something, man, and we doing your show, and my show is called Keeping It Real, so I'm going to keep it real with you. The appeal to me behind Moonlight, which is why I think it's so well thought of, is that there are two things in Hollywood that are prevalent, right?
Mm-hmm.
There is one ethnicity that's prevalent, and there's one gender that's prevalent, right? And you made a movie that is a mainstream movie that talks about, you know, same-sex homosexuality in a way that people who are heterosexual can get behind it. It is tenderly told. It is well acted, an amazing ensemble, and it's a movie above all about nurturing that does not thrust its sexuality in your face. And that's why I think Moonlight is a movie that really has mass appeal in ways that other films that have been made about this subject matter have not tapped into that. And I think there's something to be said, but the other allure is that Hollywood loves celebrating itself. So anytime you make movies about Hollywood, Hollywood gets behind those. So you're right, there's an ebb and flow here with these two movies that both are really, really popular in this community. I just think that Damien Chazelle is going to prevail above all because of the artistry and the magic and everything we talked about earlier, which may overshadow a well-told story that's well-directed with an ensemble. So that's kind of how I had to lay that out to kind of really, and that also applies to Best Picture as well, what I just said.
All right, folks, you're listening to Pick Shock. I'm your host, Kevin Sampson. I just had a great time talking about the 2017 Oscar nominations with my good friend, Tim Gordon. You can catch him at thefilmgordon.com. The Oscars will be presented live on February 26th, 7 Eastern, 4 p.m. Central. West Coast? That's not Central.
Yeah, West Coast, it'll be like 4 to red carpet starts at 4. The show will probably start at 5.
Yeah.
Also a plug. I'm not sure if you got an email yet, but you know next Tuesday, I will be sitting down with Susan Koch, the executive director of the Middleburg Film Festival, as WAFCA and Middleburg finally get together for something called The Anatomy of a Contender. We're going to watch Moonlight, which is the movie that's nominated for Best Picture and several other categories, and sit down and talk about how Middleburg chooses their movies and what made Moonlight special. I will moderate. Susan Koch will answer my questions. You want to be in the house for that, man. Next week. February
88th. All right. Man, Tim Gordon, I really appreciate it. It's always fun when we get together and we get to talk about it. If you could just go ahead and plug, how can people find you?
Man, people can read my content over at thefilmgordon.com when I decide to write any because I'm lazy. And you can read all my stuff on social media by just going to The Film Gordon on every platform, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Pinterest. I'm just Film Gordon, man.
All right. Appreciate it, Tim.
Hey, man, I try to do what I can to help. Woo! Woo!
That's all for this episode. I'd like to thank my guest, Tim Gordon, for doing what he does best. Make sure you check him out over at thefilmgordon.com. You can find Picture Lock on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Periscope. All social media is at Picture Lock Show. Watch back episodes of the TV show at youtube.com/Picture Lock Show. You can download the podcast in iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Google Play Music, and other places podcasts are downloaded. Feel free to give the show a hearty review if you're enjoying it. Make sure that you do download the podcast because you don't want to miss those unlocked episodes. And I just want to reiterate that I had a recent unlocked episode with Mary Ratliff in which we talked in depth about Hidden Figures as well as Rosebud. So that's one that you definitely want to check out, but you're not going to be able to hear it over the radio airwaves. Don't forget to check out the website, picturelockshow.com, for movie reviews, news, and to subscribe to our newsletter to get a chance to win tickets for movie screenings in the DMV. I'm about to give away some this week. If you're interested in being a guest on the show, you can fill out the form on the website and drop me a line if you're enjoying the show as well at picturelockshow@gmail.com. All music is done by Mike S. The Prophet 13. Appreciate you, bro. I'm Kevin Sampson, and until next time, I hope you stay locked on film.